Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Trevor Timm, Executive Director of the Freedom of the Press Foundation, who discusses the campaign recently launched to persuade President Obama to issue a pardon to NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden. Hugh McMillan, Senior Researcher with Food and Water Watch, who summarizes the findings of his new report revealing the Wall Street banks financing the controversial Dakota Access Pipeline. And Pat Hines, Director of the Trap Rock Center for Peace and Justice, who talks about how the military-industrial complex in the U.S. and in other nations around the world contribute to the urgent problem of climate change. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Philippines' newly elected president, Rodrigo Duterte, who has made a series of statements critical of the United States, has called for U.S. Special Forces to leave the southern island of Mindanao. U.S. Special Forces have operated in the southern Philippines since 2002, targeting the Abu Sayyaf Islamic insurgent group that has kidnapped and killed dozens of hostages. At its height, there were 1,200 U.S. troops in the southern Philippines, but that number is now down to 107, who are limited to conducting surveillance operations. In the days after the recent Association of Southeast Asian Nations summit in Laos, President Duterte rejected an agreement for dual naval patrols in the South China Sea. Duterte said the Philippines will limit patrols to its territorial waters. He also indicated the Philippines would, in the future, purchase weapons from Russia and China instead of its longtime ally and supplier, the U.S. In August, Duterte restarted peace talks with the 12,000-strong rebel Moro Islamic Liberation Front, who have fought for decades for an independent Islamic state on Mindanao. Combined with the pullback from the South China Sea, Duterte is moving away from the 1951 U.S.-Philippines Security Treaty, an important part of U.S. strategic security alliances in Southeast Asia. Alan Gross, a U.S. government subcontractor for the U.S. Agency for International Development, spent 5 years in a Havana jail after being convicted of providing Cuba's small Jewish community with internet communications equipment, including discrete SIM cards used to mask the signals of satellite phones that are generally restricted to military use. During his ordeal, Gross lost 110 pounds. Gross was released in December 2014 as part of the historic diplomatic negotiations that led to the thaw in U.S.-Cuba relations. Today, Gross remains a strong advocate of an open internet in Cuba, recently telling the El Nuevo Herald in Miami, "There are 11.3 million people who live on the island who should be furious at the government for not giving them internet access." According to the BBC, internet services remains spotty in Cuba. The government has set up 40 Wi-Fi hotspots in various cities, which offer expensive access to Facebook and Twitter, but block opposition websites. Gross, who now praises the work of President Obama and former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton for his release, told attendees at a recent conference that he became a catalyst in the U.S.-Cuba process of normalization, which he believes is irrepressible and positive. Far away from the confrontation over the Dakota Access Pipeline between the Standing Rock Sioux in North Dakota, their allies, and the company building the pipeline, Energy Transfer Partners, an earlier conflict between Texas oil company Western Refining and local opposition near Gallup, New Mexico, over an extension of a pipeline's right-of-way, illuminates the duplicitous role played by the Bureau of Indian Affairs, or BIA. The BIA was among those who pushed for an extension, and nationally manages 55 million acres in trust for Native peoples. A 6-month investigation by Stephanie Woodard of In These Times magazine reveals that the BIA often makes it cheap and easy for outside corporations to exploit Native resources. As a result, corporations are able to drill, frack, farm, and fell timber on Native lands, paying landowners little in return. Big corporations like Koch Industries, Walmart, and Dollar General profit from exploiting Native resources. In 1989, a congressional report concluded Koch Oil engaged in premeditated theft by mismeasuring the oil taken from native land. Today, native communities are among the poorest places in the U.S., where average tribal income rarely exceeds $10,000 a year, and the unemployment rate exceeds 50%. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
A campaign to persuade President Obama that he should issue a presidential pardon to NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden was launched to coincide with the opening of Oscar-winning film director Oliver Stone's newest biopic movie, Snowden. The Pardon Snowden campaign, supported by the American Civil Liberties Union, Amnesty International, and Human Rights Watch, among other groups, is working to convince Mr. Obama that Snowden's act of whistleblowing benefited the United States and enriched democratic debate worldwide. The campaign is urging citizens to write the president and sign an online petition in support of the effort. Among the many public figures supporting a Snowden pardon are U.S. Senators Bernie Sanders and Rod Wyden, Vietnam War-era whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg, Professors Noam Chomsky, Cornel West, and Lawrence Lessig, current and former government officials, including Lawrence Wilkerson, former Chief of Staff to U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell, actor Susan Sarandon, and director Terry Gilliam. Those pressing for a pardon before President Obama leaves office on January 20, 2017, say that Snowden's selfless act revealing unconstitutional warrantless dragnet surveillance of all Americans' communications led to some necessary reforms and moves toward more government accountability. Your reporter spoke with Trevor Timm, executive director of the Freedom of the Press Foundation, whose board Edward Snowden chairs from exile in Russia. Here, Timm talks about why he believes Snowden deserves a pardon and the need to protect whistleblowers and the journalists who tell their stories.
Edward Snowden, believe it or not, has kind of been a public figure for 3.5 years now. And what he revealed, you know, essentially the NSA's mass surveillance program, where the NSA was actually gathering up every single phone call record in the United States, whether you were man, woman, or child, innocent or guilty. This is billions and billions of calls per day, and this was happening without the public's knowledge whatsoever. And since Edward Snowden came forward, the Congress has passed the first intelligence reform in 40 years. The courts have ruled what Edward Snowden revealed to be illegal, and the NSA had to curtail its activities. And there's been a sea change in the way that the public views online privacy today. And so for these reasons, we are asking people to support our petition at pardonsnowden.org, which essentially calls on President Obama to use his pardon power to pardon Edward Snowden before he leaves office. Right now, Edward Snowden, fortunately, is not in jail, though he faces criminal indictment. He has been exiled in Russia for the past 3 years, and we really want to create a situation where Edward Snowden can come home to the United States with dignity.
What's the most compelling argument of those like yourself who advocate a Snowden pardon? How do you make the case against the idea that Snowden, by his release of top-secret U.S. surveillance programs, endangered national security? Of course, this has been a running mantra of many in the national security state within the U.S. government, particularly conservative commentators across the country.
Of course, and I think it's a natural question that anybody asks, especially because what they've been hearing from government officials for the past 3 years. But actually, when you look at what the government has been saying closely, they can't actually point to a single piece of evidence or a single concrete harm that has come to the United States. You know, unfortunately, the government uses national security to hide all sorts of illegal programs from United States citizens. And in the past, when similar leaks have happened or the government is about to release reports on what the CIA or the NSA is doing, they often bring up national security and claim that it will be harmed. And time after time after time, they've shown to completely exaggerate or if not just make up those threats. So, for example, there was a House Intelligence Committee report that just came out, which talked, you know, a lot about national security, yet they still couldn't point to a single thing that Edward Snowden has done that has actually harmed United States citizens. But we do know all of the benefits that we've gotten from Edward Snowden, you know, the court cases, and really a reinvigoration of democracy. The people now know that they can actually hold the government accountable for what they're doing behind closed doors under their name.
Well, Trevor, I also wanted to ask you about some of the work you're doing currently, both to protect whistleblowers and the journalists who tell their stories. There have been some very disturbing instances recently where the government has surveilled journalists about their work and connections with whistleblowers. There's also been cases where the government has recently attempted to prosecute journalists for telling the public government secrets that, in the mind of many, belong in the public domain. Tell us a bit about the work that you're doing on this score.
Yeah. You know, unfortunately, in the past 8 years under the Obama administration, there's been a record amount of whistleblowers prosecuted under the Espionage Act. And along with that, we've seen a huge increase in surveillance of journalists who are just reporting exactly what they're supposed to the American public. You know, there were a few incidents a few years ago that are fairly notorious at this point, where two Associated Press journalists were spied on by the government, a Fox News journalist. The same thing happened to the government was reading his email. One of the most famous Pulitzer Prize winning reporters in the country, New York Times reporter James Risen, almost faced jail because he was under subpoena for almost 7 years in an attempt to give up one of his sources. Even with President Obama promising to be the most transparent administration ever when he came into office, we have really seen an increase in the amount of surveillance that has happened to journalists. And so at Freedom of the Press Foundation, we lobby the government to provide extra protections to journalists. We sue the government under the Freedom of Information Act to release more information about what they're doing behind closed doors. And we develop technology that hopefully can protect journalists and whistleblowers when they're communicating online where the law falls short. In the past few years, we've seen a few successes on this front. You know, the government has kind of curtailed at least their most egregious acts that were happening in the first Obama term. But it's certainly a long road. And, you know, there are hundreds of other governments around the world who are intent on prosecuting and arresting and potentially killing journalists. So it's definitely a long fight.
That was Trevor Timm, Executive Director of the Freedom of the Press Foundation. Learn more about the Pardon Snowden campaign and the foundation by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In recent developments in the ongoing opposition campaign to stop construction of the Dakota Access oil pipeline in North Dakota, a federal appeals court in Washington, D.C. on September 16th ordered a temporary halt to construction of the 1,100-mile pipeline near the Missouri River, upstream from the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation. The stop work order is in effect until the court can rule on a preliminary injunction sought by the Standing Rock Tribe that was initially denied in federal court on September 9th. The tribe and their allies opposed the pipeline because of sacred burial sites in the area and the threat to its drinking water supply posed by a potential oil spill. Climate activists are working to block fossil fuel pipelines nationwide that contribute to global warming. Earlier on Labor Day weekend, security guards hired by the company building the pipeline, Energy Transfer Partners, pepper-sprayed and physically assaulted protesters using attack dogs who reportedly bit at least six people. Video of the violent confrontation was captured by journalist Amy Goodman and her Democracy Now! Film crew, which later went viral across the news media and internet. However, 5 days later, the state of North Dakota issued an arrest warrant for Goodman, charging her with criminal trespassing, a clear violation of the First Amendment. Your reporter spoke with Hugh McMillan, senior researcher with the group Food and Water Watch, who talks about his recent report titled, Who's Banking on the Dakota Access Pipeline? Here he details the Wall Street banks behind the project and their conflict of interest with indigenous communities and other people living along the pipeline route.
This pipeline, Dakota Access, is part of a larger project called the Bakken Pipeline, Bakken Crude Pipeline, being pushed by Energy Transfer Partners. Energy Transfer Partners and its affiliate, Sunoco Logistics, have been the driving force behind this project, and they're partnering with Phillips 66, Enbridge, and Marathon. Enbridge and Marathon just bought in about a month ago for $2 billion. Now, the full project would run from near the Canadian border on down to the Texas Gulf Coast. So Dakota Access running from North Dakota, 1,100 miles to southern Illinois, but it would connect with Energy Transfer Partners pipeline being converted to transport the oil farther, another 700 miles to Texas refineries and potentially also export facilities. Oil would also be sent from southern Illinois to the East Coast on what we've come to call bomb trains. There are 17 financial institutions, banks from all over the world, really, who loaned Dakota Access $2.5 billion for this Bakken pipeline project. And most of these banks and numerous others have also committed hundreds of millions each to the Energy Transfer family of companies to help these entities build out more oil and gas infrastructure, to support more fracking for oil and gas, and to support North American exports of oil and gas, all in the false name of energy security.
When you look at the profit motive here versus the utility and necessity from the point of view of these companies, at least their corporate line, that it's necessary for fossil fuel infrastructure, where do you find the flaws in these arguments that this pipeline, as well as others in this network of pipelines, is necessary?
This project is really just a slice of a much larger fracking pie for these banks. Six banks alone, Wells Fargo, Bank of America, J.P. Morgan, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, and Citibank, they hold over $200 billion in oil and gas industry loans. And they've succeeded, these banks, working together with oil and gas companies, front groups, and think tanks. They've succeeded in establishing a U.S. energy policy that equates widespread fracking with energy security. Our executive director at Food and Water Watch calls this tangle of interest frackopoly, and the banks aim to get paid back through widespread drilling and fracking for decades to maximize oil and gas production. The place where we find flaws is that this is coming at the expense of targeted communities and the stability of our climate. We've yet to align U.S. energy policy with the urgency of climate science. We still aim to maximize oil and gas production when science is clear. We must maximize what we keep in the ground.
Now, how does federal policy vis-a-vis the United States agreement at the Paris Climate Summit to trim back our contributions here in this country to carbon emissions and the like from fossil fuels, how does that line up with these major fracking projects in places like North Dakota?
Well, there's a real disconnect, frankly. The DOE, a year ago, it published its quadrennial technology review. This document was billed as one that examines the current status of clean energy technologies in a chapter titled Advancing Clean Energy Technologies. Permeability manipulation is the agency's preferred name for fracking, and that's given it as an example of an area where improvements can lead toward what the DOE calls a mastery of the subsurface. Now, the DOE is anticipating having this mastery of the subsurface and being able to create negative emissions by capturing carbon dioxide and pumping it under the ground. You know, I think this is a fool's errand. True energy security will only come when we're meeting our energy needs without destabilizing the climate and without sacrificing people's health and welfare along the way.
That was Hugh McMillan, senior researcher with Food and Water Watch. Find a link to his report, Who's Banking on the Dakota Access Pipeline, and related articles by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Former presidential candidate and Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders called climate change the most urgent threat to national security. But most government officials and most peace activists don't necessarily make the connection between the havoc that the climate crisis is already creating and will create in the future and the issues of peace and security. One glaring example is the drought in Syria, which pushed tens of thousands of Syrians off their land and into the cities, exacerbating conflicts which precipitated the civil war that has raged for the past 5.5 years, killing up to 500,000 Syrians and displacing millions more. One group that does make that connection is the Trap Rock Center for Peace and Justice in Greenfield, Massachusetts. The center's director, Pat Hines, spoke earlier this month to a meeting in Connecticut that was co-sponsored by the groups Promoting Enduring Peace and the Connecticut chapter of 350.org, which brought peace and climate activists together. Hines is a retired professor of urban environmental health and has worked for decades as an educator, researcher, writer, and activist on issues of environmental justice, feminism, and the health effects of war. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Hines about how resources dedicated to the military in the U.S. and other nations around the world contributes to the urgent crisis of climate change.
The U.S. military is the largest institutional user of oil in the world, and it is the largest institutional contributor to climate change. The key book, which came out a few years ago, called The Green Zone by Barry Sanders, is probably the only book thus far written by an author who has tried to ferret out documentation in terms of the amount of oil used by the Pentagon. His conclusion is that the Pentagon contributes 5% of emissions to climate change, and no other institution contributes 5% of the global emissions to climate change. His analysis does not include the NATO nations, for example, which our government badgers consistently to contribute to build up their contribution of military budget to NATO, so pushing countries to build their military budgets to be equivalent to 2% of their country budgets. And that means they, too, scaling up with respect to all of these military planes, tanks, ships, and the manufacture, the testing of them in war games, etc., all of this contributing more in terms of militarization and warming. And then also the new Cold War tensions, which the military historian Michael Clare has written about recently, among what he calls the great powers, those being the U.S., China, and Russia. So the new Cold War tensions among these great powers, which then causes the buildup of militaries in all of these countries, plus war games with Asian partners in our pivot to Asia to surround China. And just to give an example from one war that we have conducted, this is information which Oil Change International, that is a research group, has collected and put together. The full cost of the Iraq War, which have been estimated to be about $3 trillion, that money have covered all of the global investments in renewable power generation needed between the time they did the report around 2007 through 2030 to reverse global warming trends. So another point about militarism and war and climate change is the trade-off point. if you are dedicating 52% of your discretionary budget, as we are doing in the United States, to the Pentagon and to all of the activities I've talked about, that is the military-industrial complex as well, if we are dedicating that money, that percent of our budget, we are then taking it away from all of the other aspects of the discretionary budget: health, education, welfare, housing, environmental protection, climate change research, transportation, etc. Another piece that they have done as a way of analysis in terms of militarism being an engine of climate change is that rebuilding Iraqi schools, homes, businesses, bridges, roads, and hospitals polarized by the war, as well as new security walls and barriers, would require millions of tons of cement. Cement is one of the largest industrial sources of greenhouse gas emissions.
Patricia Hines, there's been a lot written about how the Pentagon is such a big promoter within the federal government of the need to address climate change and that it's taking the lead in that regard.
First, the greening of the Pentagon, I would compare to a whitened sepulcher. There is nothing that they can do that can possibly affect the great damage that so much of our resources dedicated to militarism and war do. That said, most of the greening of the Pentagon would encompass putting solar, wind, into bases that they have for electricity and research on alternative fuels.
You said in your talk that you address groups concerned about peace and groups concerned about climate change, but you rarely address a group that's concerned about both.
I think we'd make much faster progress and more progress if we brought them together. As someone in the audience said as I was speaking, we work politically in silos. And so I think there's much more power in grassroots groups working in partnership together, which does not mean that we all do the same thing. It's that we support each other's issues, we continue to make the connections between them and build bridges between them so that we have a larger and larger base of activism against war and on behalf of mitigating climate change and becoming a renewable country.
That was Patricia Hines, director of the Trap Rock Center for Peace and Justice. Learn more about the work being done at the Trap Rock Center by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. And support our show, which is celebrating 25 years on the air in 2016. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.